Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom in the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, and I will be for the first 2 hours of our program today. In our third hour, my friend and colleague Carl Wolfson, who does our morning show here on AM 620 KPOJ in Portland, Oregon, is going to be filling in for me as I'm hopping on a plane to head over to Grand Rapids, Michigan, where tomorrow I will be doing our show live from one of the studios of WTKG, and tomorrow night from 6:30 to 7:30 in Grand Rapids at the UAW offices, and I'll give you the details on that coming in from the next break. I'll be doing a book signing and a talk, and there's actually even going to be free food. So in Grand Rapids, you're going to want to know about that. Anyhow, a number of things that I want to get into in this first hour, and they all come under this rubric, this heading, this overall concept of, are we going to let the thieves win? Is it in our nature to be thieves even? Because this is the essence of the John McCain Republican Party philosophy and has been basically since about 1870 when the Republican Party was taken over by the robber barons, that this kind of Darwinistic notion that the powerful survive and only the powerful should survive. Our quote for the day, by the way, from Woodrow Wilson, the president of the United States, Democratic president of the United States during World War I. He said, a conservative is a man who sits and thinks, but mostly sits. I want to take it even a little farther than that and suggest to you that there is this bizarre notion of human nature, this fundamentally dysfunctional notion of human nature, which has come to inform the conservative movement and the Republican Party and the libertarian movement and party, by the way, as well, that at its core is really and truly destructive and is destroying America, frankly. And I just want to give you a few examples of this, just, from today's news. And how this came about. And then I want to tell you about dictyostelium. Yeah. And why that means something. For example, just as a few frames. I got this email from Joel. I don't know if he wants his last name on the air, so I won't say it. But thanks, Joel, for this. He says, the best description of the spent fuel dilemma I've ever heard of. This is, nuclear power, right? The cons are out there saying, hey, we need to build a bunch of new nuclear power plants. At the same time, Al Gore has come out and said, hey, within a decade, let's go to 100% of our electricity being produced by renewable sources. And I would suspect that the Republican funder of the Swift Boat veterans, T. Boone Pickens, agrees with him. In any case, Joel sent me this email. He said, if the pyramids of Egypt, and just think about this for a minute, if the pyramids of Egypt had been the storage places for the radioactive fuel rods of that day's nuclear power stations, the pharaohs of 3,000 years ago would have gotten their 25 years of electric power to enjoy. And today, we would still have to be guarding their pyramid nuclear waste stations and would have to continue to guard them for at least 22,000 years with no benefit at all in our own lives or in our children's lives. That's the legacy of nuclear power. It's crazy. So here we have in today's paper, in today's Financial Times, front page, the two top stories. First, sovereign funds cut exposure to weak U.S. dollar. And this is by Harry Sender in New York. He says, our one big sovereign fund in the Gulf has cut its dollar-denominated holdings from more than 80% a year ago to less than 60%, while China's State Administration of Foreign Exchange, SAFE, has been looking to strike deals with private equity firms in Europe as part of its strategy to reduce its dollar holdings. In other words, one of the big funds in the Gulf, and this is the Qatar Investment Authority, and China, who's sitting on $1.6 billion in foreign reserves, denominated in dollars. They're both looking to get out of the dollar. Why are they looking to get out of the dollar? Because the dollar is collapsing. Why is the dollar collapsing? Because of 30 years of incredibly destructive conservative economic policies here in the United States, driven by this fundamental belief that greed is good and greed drives all things. That if only everybody behaved in their own self-interest all the time, everything would be great. And that the only reason that anybody should be in government is because there's something in it for them. The other story, and in fact, I want to get into more detail on that in a minute. The other story, the front page of today's Financial Times, UBS, the bank, used, quote, cloak of secrecy, end quote, on U.S. tax. You know, USB, the big bank that Phil Graham was the vice chairman of. Phil Graham, the lead economic advisor to John McCain. U.S. congressional investigators will today accuse UBS and Liechtenstein's LTG Group of using the cloak of banking secrecy laws to help American clients evade billions of dollars in taxes. UBS told committee investigators it holds 19,000 accounts worth roughly $18 billion for U.S. citizens that it has not declared to the IRS. In 2001, when a new tax rules under the so-called Qualified Intermediary Program required foreign banks to disclose the names of clients holding U.S. securities, UBS's U.S. citizens in Switzerland sold more than $2 billion in such assets to avoid disclosure. This all leads back to this guy, Heinrich Kieber, a former LTG employee who just was fed up with this and burned a CD, three CDs actually, with the names of all the, not just Americans, Europeans as well, wealthy millionaires and billionaires who were using Liechtenstein's banks and their banking secrecy laws to avoid paying taxes in their native countries. And, Phil Graham, the gnome of Zurich, the vice chairman of UBS Securities. Very interesting. So what does this mean? Where do we go with all this? Well, let's just look at a couple of examples here. First of all, the dollar is falling. The U.S. economy is falling in part because of the subprime crisis. Where did the subprime crisis begin? You go back to February 14th of this year, when Eliot Spitzer was still governor of New York. And he wrote an op-ed for the New York Times. He opens it by saying, several years ago, state attorneys general and others involved in consumer protection began to notice a marked increase in a range of predatory lending practices by mortgage lenders. Some were misrepresenting the terms of loans. Some were making loans without regard to consumers' ability to repay. Some were making loans with deceptive teaser rates that later ballooned astronomically, packing loans with undisclosed charges and fees, or even paying illegal kickbacks. He says this broadly across the states, the 50 state attorneys general, they all perceived this as a looming crisis. He's talking about several years ago. New York, several state legislators, legislatures, including New York, enacted laws to stop such practices. So what did the Bush administration do? Well, Spitzer lays it out in this New York Times op-ed from February 14th. He said, not only did the Bush administration do nothing to protect consumers, it embarked on an aggressive and unprecedented campaign to prevent states from protecting their residents. They used the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, the OCC. This is a 140-year-old agency. They went back to an 1863 law called the National Bank Act, which said that the OCC, the federal government, basically, has the authority, when in things having to do with banks, has the authority to prevent states from passing laws that override federal regulations and laws. So to quote Eliot Spitzer, the OCC, during the height of the predatory lending crisis, the OCC invoked a clause from the 1863 National Bank Act to issue formal opinions preempting all state regulatory lending laws, thereby rendering them inoperative. In other words, they basically shut down every state effort to stop predatory lending. The OCC also promulgated new rules that prevented states from enforcing any of their own consumer protection laws against national banks. He points out every single one of the 50 state attorneys general across the United States fought this and lost. This is what the Bush administration did. They said, oh, predatory lending? Fine with us. Oh, you states want to try and stop it? We're not going to let you stop it. What we're seeing right now with the banking crisis is the same thing that we saw with the Enron crisis. You recall the Enron crisis, the wonders of Enron. And it all goes back to this idea. Ayn Rand said it best. She said, altruism, that is, you know, working in the public interest, is immoral because self-sacrifice is fundamentally incompatible with the objective requirements of human life. Self-sacrifice, according to Rand, this is from the Wikipedia entry on altruism, is the worst kind of moral transgression because it fundamentally undermines the basic principle of a living entity, optimization towards something better and not something worse. In other words, selfish is good, greed is good. She argued that if altruism as an expression of self-sacrifice were universally and consistently applied, humankind would not remain in existence. Well, she was wrong. And we're seeing the application of that philosophy that started during the Reagan years right now. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is Tom Hartman.
Reminder, tomorrow night from 6:30 to 7:30 p.m. in Grand Rapids, Michigan, I'll be at the UAW regional offices. That's on East Beltline Avenue Northeast at Leonard Street Northeast in Grand Rapids. Put on by WTKG and the UAW. We'll be doing a book signing, a little riff, and a dinner buffet courtesy of Lanning's Catering. So it should be a whole lot of fun. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman program, brought to you, by the way, in part by the Teamsters, fighting to pass the Employee Free Choice Act. Find out more about that at teamster.org. We're talking about altruism and greed, and the epitome of greed, I think, and self-serving self-interest is the Bush administration acting in ways that are fundamentally un-American and undemocratic. And Dennis Kucinich, Congressman Dennis Kucinich, has called him out on it in so many ways and done such a fine job of it over the years. And now this is really coming to a head with this single article of impeachment that's getting to John Conyers' committee this morning. Congressman Kucinich is with us on the line. Congressman, welcome to the show.
Tom, I really appreciate being on your show. Thank you.
Well, we're always pleased to have you here, Congressman, and I salute you for what you've been doing, as I said, all these years, and from the first time you and I met working on the Department of Peace, I think almost a decade ago to now. In any case, the House voted on Tuesday, 238-10, to send your article of impeachment to the Judiciary Committee. Nancy Pelosi has said that, essentially, if I understand this correctly, this will not be an impeachment hearing, but it will be a broad scope hearing. Can you give us the inside skinny on what's going on here?
Well, for the first time, all of the efforts of people all over the country are finally going to get an opportunity for a hearing in Judiciary of the issues that we believe are significant enough to merit an impeachment, and I'm going to be presenting my articles of impeachment to the committee for their consideration. While they have made it clear that they're not going to entertain an impeachment process, they have for the first time indicated that they want to hear about the evidence that has that's pretty much well established on a public record, but which I've put together in resolutions, which really speak to a great lie that's been told to people of this country at enormous cost to our troops, the innocent people in Iraq, our national resources, our reputation in the world. So it's an important beginning towards a process of truth and reconciliation, which this country surely needs.
I got an email this morning from Greg in Missoula, Montana, listening on our affiliate there in Missoula, who said he called Conyers' office this morning, and the response he got was, quote, disheartening. I'm not sure exactly what the response was, but he points out the House Judiciary Committee has their own website. It's judiciary.house.gov, and they have their own phone number, and people can call them. If our listeners were to contact Mr. Conyers or other members of the Judiciary Committee, particularly if they happen to be from a district that one is in, what should they say?
Well, the hearing's on the 25th, so there is a hearing, and I think we should take, all of us should take some comfort that we were able to break the silence.
So we should thank them.
Well, I would go as far as to say thank, but I'd say that we appreciate that an effort is being made to open up the discussion, because that's the first thing. And once we get our foot in the door on this issue, then we have to ask, If it is agreed by members of Congress that this administration has lied to take us into a war, then the question has to be, what do we do about it? And, of course, my remedy would be impeachment, but they may decide on something else. But the point is that if there's no consequences at all, Tom, this country is in more trouble than we know.
Yeah, absolutely. And impeachment doesn't mean removal from office. It means an indictment. This is just the beginning of a process which may well not end in a removal from office. But the one really extraordinary thing about it is, if I read the Constitution right, it will prevent, if Bush is under impeachment at the time that he leaves office, he won't be able to issue pardons for anybody involved in the crimes for which he's been indicted.
I don't know that that's true. I don't think that the process of impeachment, absent a removal from office, has any bearing legally on the president's rights under Article.
Maybe I'm misreading it. Section 2, paragraph 1 of Article 2, he may require the opinion of writing the principal officer in each of the. And he shall have the power to grant reprieves and pardons for offenses against the United States, except in cases of impeachment.
Well, here's how I would read that. I would read that as saying that he can't pardon himself.
Ah, I see. Okay.
But
bummer.
You know what? but let me just say this, that you have called that to my attention. I'm going to reject that because I did not know that. I think it relates to that he can't pardon anyone who's under impeachment. Who has been impeached, and I think that would be not only himself, but it would relate to Mr. Cheney or to judges or to anyone else who could be subject to an impeachment.
Yeah, and any cabinet officer is, and
right.
Maybe a broad stroke impeachment process.
But here's the thing that I'm concerned about, Tom, is that if we continue to live a lie about Iraq, it has enormous consequences for Iran, the rest of the world, for ourselves, for our children. So what I'm trying to do is to force a discussion on the truth and then help this country set the stage for a process of truth and reconciliation.
Absolutely. And Congressman, is your website still Kucinich.us?
It certainly is.
Okay.
We have a petition on it, which could be useful to people.
Great. People can check it out, Kucinich.us. And Congressman Dennis Kucinich, thanks so much for what you're doing.
Always appreciative. Thanks, Tom.
Keep us up to date. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
And Ron was a whiz bang on the dial. Jesus.
Remember Enron?
They had a catchy name, and they put it on the baseball park downtown.
So this ties in too.
Enron took my money.
Yeah, Enron took a whole bunch of people's money.
We lost it all, they say. With questionable accounting, I gutted my 401k. I became a papa and a pop in a couple of days.
So anyhow, here's, going back to the Enron scandal, as I said, you know, let me pull all these different threads together from the criminal behavior of the Bush administration in Iraq, which has made a number of war millionaires and war billionaires, to the usurping of the office of the governor of California. You recall before the energy crisis, or in the early days of the so-called energy crisis in California, Ken Lay had a secret meeting with Arnold Schwarzenegger. Nobody knew why at the time. I think, you know, in retrospect, it's pretty obvious. Gray Davis, on March 29th, 2001, met with George Bush at the Century Plaza Hotel in West Los Angeles. And at that time, prices were spiking past 200 megawatts an hour, and begged Bush to allow him to put caps on the prices of energy, to do something, because basically Enron was taking down his state. Now, Enron and their employees had given more than $1 million to George Bush in the 2000 campaign, to Bush and the Republican Party. They paid for much of the Bush inaugural, the big fancy ball. Bush employees and aides used the Enron corporate jet during the whole stink in Florida, where they were, you know, going down to Florida and trying to stop the recount. So Enron was just totally involved in this. And we learned later that Enron traders were having these kind of conversations. Let me turn that back up.
Burn, baby, burn. That's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, see, this was, you know, fires that were taking out power lines.
California. He steals money from California to the tune of about a billion.
Can you rephrase that?
Would you rephrase? He's talking about Ken Lay. You know, he just stole money from California, so the trader says, okay, I'll rephrase.
Okay, he arbitrages the California market to the tune of $1 million a day.
Yeah, here's another one. This is, can you shut down that boiler? Can you take down the power so we can jack the price up?
If you took down the steamer, how long would it take to get it back up?
Oh, it's not something you want to just be turning on and off every hour. Let's put it that way.
Well, why don't you just go ahead and shut her down?
Just go ahead and shut her down, yeah.
And taking all the money back from you guys? All the money you guys stole from those poor grandmothers of California?
Yeah, Grandma Millie, man.
Yeah, now she wants her f***ing money back for all the power you charged right up.
Yeah, and on it goes, right? And so this is part of a philosophy, which is get rich at other people's expense, and that's a fine thing because that's actually the best thing. That's the behavior that is optimal. This is the libertarian / conservative / Republican philosophy, which is that only greed is good, and that any kind of behavior that doesn't facilitate greed ultimately isn't going to work in the public interest. And they'll be quite straightforward in saying so. I mean, this is the core of the Phil Graham economic philosophy. It's the core of John McCain's economics. And you know, I shared with you the quote earlier from Ayn Rand. And so you pull it all together, and you see how the economy is crashing. I mean, real income, this is from a piece Robert Freeman did for Common Dreams, real income for the median male worker is still below what it was when Reagan came into office. After 7 years of so-called growing GDP, real median incomes for all workers are still below where they were when Bush came into office. The ratio of debt to income for the average American has doubled since Reagan came into office. It was 65% when he came into office. In other words, most people had whatever their income was, about 65% they had debt representing 65% of that. Now, most Americans have debt representing 135% of their income. In other words, the average American is upside down in terms of debt, not just their home. The price of oil is more than quintupled. Housing prices are crashed more than 20%. Mortgage rates are rising. You know, on it goes. Unemployment goes up. Food stamp usage at a record high. Duration of time on unemployment is rising. Consumer spending is at 72% of GDP, above the historic average of 67%. But the only thing that's fueling this is credit. People are borrowing money. And the folks, the Phil Graham, John McCain economists look at this and go, yeah, you know, this is great. This is great. Have people borrow money and spend it. Let's just encourage more borrowing and spending. After all, it works for the federal government, right? Borrow and spend. I mean, you hear Bush, you hear these guys saying, tax and spend, that's a terrible thing. Well, what are you going to do then? You're going to do what Reagan did. You're going to borrow from your children and grandchildren and spend it. And, you know, and just to pull all this stuff together, this, you know, morality and politics and morality and altruism, Dictyocilium discoideum, and I'm sure a biologist can correct my pronunciation. Dictyocilium is a funny little organism. It is an amoeba, normally, a single-cell organism. But if it doesn't have enough food, well, and these amoeba will form together and form a slime, basically, you know, a slime layer. It eats bacteria. If it doesn't have enough food, if it can't find enough bacteria, it'll actually form itself into what looks like a slug, and it'll move, like, you know, it'll crawl across a petri dish or across a rock looking for food. And the individual amoeba that form this colony, the ones that are on the outside, die very quickly from their exposure to air and the rock and whatnot. They volunteer to die for the community. And if, as this now looking like an animal organism, doesn't find food, then it turns itself into what looks like a little tree, and about 20% of the amoeba give themselves up to become the stalk, and about 80% become spore pods at the top, where they get scattered to the wind when the spore pod gets burst. And the whole world of science right now is trying to figure out, how is it that individual amoeba will behave in a way that's altruistic, will give up their lives for the greater good? And could this be a model in biology? And I would say, hey, you know, the simple biological model is the body. You know, that you've got all these cons out there saying, no, it's all about competition. It's all about competition. Competition is the only thing, you know, it's all about Darwin, et cetera, et cetera. And the really simple answer to that is, does your liver compete with your kidneys? If it does, that's called cancer. When the cells of one individual organ start using up all the energy available to the body at the expense of other organs, that's called cancer. And I would submit to you that the economic policies of this administration, and going all the way back for 30 years, the economic policies, the Greenspan-Rubin economic policies that ruled the Clinton administration, the right-wing economic policies, the Reagan economic policies that ruled the Bush elder and the Reagan administration, for 30 years now, we have been seeing economic policies in this country that are cancerous. And the body politic and the body economic of this country is dying as a result of it. We've gone from being, and when Reagan came into office, to having 25% of our workforce unionized, to now 7% of the private workforce is unionized, with good wages and good salaries and good benefits. We've gone from being the biggest producer of finished goods in the world. The world's manufacturing floor was the United States in 1980 when Reagan came into power. We are now the world's largest importer of manufactured goods. And you take Amtrak up and down the Northeast Corridor, and it's just amazing, the mile after mile after mile of shuttered factories that you go by with all the smashed in windows. And that's just one example. That's the easy example. We've gone from being the biggest creditor in the world to being the biggest debtor in the world. I mean, this is all the result of this change in thinking that happened in the 1980s, where we went from the old Dwight Eisenhower Republican notion that politics is about serving the public, to the new Reagan perspective that politics is about getting what you can. Because after all, that's what everybody has to do, because as Ayn Rand said, altruism is the ultimate evil. These are two fundamentally contrasting worldviews. So, you know, anyhow, I just wanted to lay all that out to you. Sean in Vancouver. Hey, Sean.
Good morning, Tom. Hey, man, keep tearing it up. We're so lucky to have you on the air.
Thank you.
Tom, I find myself getting very angry and exasperated at the hypocrisy and the double standards of these Republicans who defend capitalism for years and then turn around and use government, use socialism to save their system.
Right.
But then I have to remind myself that, hey, wait a minute. These guys, you know, they believe in the ideas of Friedrich Nietzsche, the idea that might makes right. And
yeah,
they basically have no sense of ethics other than they're much too important to adhere to the same laws and morality that poor people do. I was wondering if you had any thoughts on that.
I think you just said it. You said it perfectly, Sean. And it's not just Nietzsche, but, you know, from Nietzsche forward, you know, and Sartre and von Hayek and you can put the whole thing together from the Ubermensch to the Darwinian ideas of von Hayek and Milton Friedman.
Sure, in many ways they're all just second rate versions of Nietzsche in a sense. I mean,
yeah,
you know,
yeah, and it all goes back to Darwin's cousin, who I'm drawing a blank on his name right now. But Darwin's cousin was an economist, and he was the guy who largely, you know, help rewrite Darwin. You know, I mean, in Origin of the Species, Darwin talks, survival of the fittest only appears once in the entire book, and Darwin really talks about cooperation. Just like our bodies are cooperative organisms, and most social things are cooperative. But his cousin, he took this thing and used Darwin's analysis of the finches in the Galapagos Island and whatnot. Thank you, Sean, for the call, by the way. Took this stuff and turned it into an economic justification for feudalism, for the Victorian era, you know, the politics, the economics, rather, of Scrooge and Marley, you know. Hey, Mr. Scrooge, may I have a lump of coal? No, it'll cost me an extra pinch. 45 minutes past.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
On the factor is the facts are often wrong. Slander those who can't defend themselves without an ounce of shame. Make everything about himself, and that's how he became.
Vicious, inadequate with a capital V, person who blinded by ideology.
You might be someone who'll dig it. You might be O'Reilly's kind, especially if you're a bigot with a closed and tiny mind.
Shut
up! If you have no use for reason, then you'll love the way he acts. He'll tell you what you want to hear, regardless of the facts.
Welcome back to the only noon to 3 Eastern Time progressive talk show in America that has beat Rush Limbaugh on two different markets and beats Bill O'Reilly consistently all over the, well, not all over the country, but in many, many, many places. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-303-2270. Kevin in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, listening on Wins. Hey, Kevin.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call, man.
Yeah.
You know, Tom, as I listen to these pearls of wisdom that you're bringing forth in terms of the policies and the disastrous, the destructive effect that it's having on our nation, you know, I'm coming to a conclusion that we're not seeing flawed policies. We're seeing a hidden agenda,
yeah.
And that should change our total paradigm of our seriousness that we consider these things.
Yes, I absolutely agree, Kevin. This is not incompetence. This and to the extent that it's greed elevated to the level of a religion. And a good part of it, if you go back and you read the writings of conservatives in the 60s and 70s, and then you go back and you read the writings of the conservatives in the 1770s, like, you know, John Adams and Alexander Hamilton, the conservatives of that day, they were very concerned in the 1770s that there was so much affluence that there was, that the rabble were becoming restless. And, you know, many of them, John Adams actually ended up being in favor of the American Revolution and was a real patriot in that regard, although he was a lousy president. But the conservatives of the day were saying, you know, this is a bad thing, having a strong middle class. And this is the same thing they were saying in the 1960s and 70s, as they were looking at the hippies and the civil rights movement and all this stuff, you know, and in fact, it started with the beatniks. And they were saying, you know, this middle class, it has too much power. It has too much money. These kids have too much time on their hands. Ronald Reagan did away with free education at the University of California. He said, why should I pay for kids to go to school when they're going to protest my policies? You know, in other words, you know, let them eat kids. I mean, so this is a purposeful takedown of the middle class, Kevin. And thanks for the call. I lay it out in my book, Screwed. In fact, I, you know, just document the whole thing. You can go back and just find them writing about it. Alan Greenspan in 1997 in the Wall Street Journal. Alan Greenspan, chairman of the Fed, said that his job as chairman of the Fed was to maintain a certain minimum threshold of insecurity among workers. In other words, keep people so afraid that they're going to lose their jobs by raising interest rates, which slows down the economy, which throws people out of work, to maintain that certain minimum level of insecurity so that people will not revolt, so that they won't join unions, so that they're afraid to join unions, so that they're afraid to be out in the streets. I mean, Alan Greenspan can't brag to the Wall Street Journal about this. Roger in Vancouver. Hey, Roger.
Yes, thank you, Tom, for taking my call. My point follows on to the last caller very closely. I couldn't help but think about Naomi Klein's book, Shock Doctrine, when
yes.
I was thinking about this this whole process.
Oh, she's so spot on. She is so spot on.
We should be looking for more shocks down the road as this policy continues to advance.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And they will use every single one they can, from the war in Iraq to the housing crisis to the price of oil to you name it. This is all about that, absolutely. And the shock doctrine, thank you for the call. The shock doctrine is just, you know, another way of using this, you know, well, anyway, I'm off ranting here. Andre in Columbia, South Carolina. Hey, Andre. Oh, I'm sorry. It helps if you push the button. Hey, Andre.
Hey, Tom. How you doing today?
Just great. What's up?
Well, I consider you and Mr. Kucinich to be true patriots in a sea of false patriots.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, and I support the impeachment of George Bush 100%.
Amen.
My question is, do you think that since we've seen in Vietnam that the people who truly profit from war are the Halliburtons and the Boeings, and big corporations have a huge interest in keeping and manipulating politicians to keep it going?
Yeah.
You think it's time we went to the true heart of the beast?
Yeah,
now profit?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that we should be breaking up we should be enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act again. We need to be breaking up these huge monopolies. You can start with the oil monopoly, for example, that have become giant parasitic leeches on the back of our economy. It's increasingly difficult and amazingly difficult, frankly, for small entrepreneurs, new and young businesses to start out, for local businesses to operate, you know, local retail stores. I mean, a Walmart comes into a community, and typically 100 businesses go out of business, locally owned businesses go out of business. This has been going on for 30 years, just the absolute destruction of the American economy at the level of the small and medium-sized business. And thank you, Andre, for the call. I mean, I'm going to invoke a name here, and this is what Karl Marx, I was talking with Nicole Sandler about this on Wednesday this morning. Nicole, that Karl Marx properly diagnosed the problem in Das Kapital. He did not offer a solution that worked. You know, communism didn't work. Marxism didn't work. Well, it works in small communities. It works in a kibbutz. It works in a tribe, but it doesn't work at the level of a nation state. But his diagnosis was, if you do not in some way restrain capitalism, if you have laissez-faire capitalism, absolutely raw, naked, unrestrained capitalism, then the big fish will start to eat the medium-sized fish will eat all the small fish, and then the big fish will eat all the medium-sized fish, and you get nothing left but big fish. And that's not a healthy system. That's not a healthy environment. Even in a traditional ecosystem, you know, reefs around the ocean, there are places for the little fish to hide. The system is designed, and the medium-sized fish, I mean, each one has its own niche. And economically, you should have the same thing. There should be, if you're going to build an economy, let's build it based on biological systems. Let's have on natural systems. Let's have an economy where there are protected spaces for small businesses, and there are protected spaces for medium-sized businesses, or appropriate spaces for them, rather than just kicking the door open and saying, oh, yeah, free trade, free economy, laissez-faire, we'll let them do anything they want, and what you end up with is Walmart ruling the world and basically China becoming the manufacturing floor for the planet as long as they can continue to supply the cheapest labor around in the fastest and most efficient way. And if any of their people get out of line and don't like the program, they can ship them off to prison and sell them your liver on demand. I mean, that's what it comes down to. It is absolutely inhuman what happens when capitalism is absolutely unregulated. 57 minutes past the hour.
This is Tom Hartman. You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Welcome back to our second hour. Dr. John Lott is on the line with us, conservative scholar and author. His latest book, Freedomnomics. His website, John R. Lott, LOTT.blogspot.com. And Dr. Lott, welcome to the program.
Good to be back on again.
Thank you. Thank you for rejoining us. You have written recently a piece that was published over at Fox News on the 17th of June titled No Profits, No Oil, in which you're basically saying, you know, the oil companies, if we want to have cheaper oil, we need to let the oil companies have higher profits. I don't understand that equation.
Well, if you want to encourage them to make more oil, if you want them to, companies to make more of anything, you have to, they have to be more profits out there for them to get. The more profits they can make, the harder and faster they are going to try to go and develop more oil or more of any other type of product that's there. If you go and try to put on the windfall profits tax or other things that are being proposed, you're not going to solve the problem in terms of having high gas prices. In fact, if anything, what's going to happen is you're going to have higher prices in the future than you otherwise would have had.
You know, if we had if we had actually an open and competitive market for oil, what you're saying would make sense. But what we have is monopoly capitalism here. We've got, you know, our oil business, the at least with regard to the United States, the oil coming in and out of the United States is basically controlled by about five corporations. Why not break these companies up? Why not enforce the Sherman Antitrust Act and then let the smaller companies compete, as you suggest, and make a profit?
Well, it's a world market for oil. Exxon Mobil...
All the more reason to break them up.
No, but Exxon Mobil has like 4% of the world oil. I mean,
they may have 4% of the world's oil. That's because you've got a lot of state actors in the game. But look at the amount of the oil in the coming into and going out of the United States that they're controlling. I mean, it's got to be much more than 4%.
But if you go look over the last 10 or 20 or 30 years, you can explain almost the entire change in the price of oil going up and down day to day or week to week by what's happened to the world price. As the world price goes up, our oil goes up. It's not like they're disconnected. It's not like they're...
No, I understand. And that's why I'm saying you have an illegal cartel in OPEC. And it's illegal under U.S. law, and it's illegal under a variety of international laws, including the WTO. And you've got big oil companies who are participating with this, going along just, hey, this is a great thing. Yeah, let's do it. And they're exacerbating the situation. And then here in the United States, if we're really talking about gasoline prices, which I think, you know, at the end of the day, most people, it's not what a barrel of oil costs. It's, you know, what does kerosene cost, home heating oil, and what does diesel and gasoline cost? In that case, you're looking at companies that are you know, with regard to refinery capacity, are holding that down. And with regard to the big oil companies, I mean, you've got conservatives like yourself running around saying, actually, I shouldn't characterize you. I don't know your position on this, but you've got the Republican Party running around saying we need to give more oil leases to the oil companies. Right now, the oil companies are sitting on 10,000 active leases on known oil reserves on over 60 million acres of U.S. land, 10,000 leases that they're sitting on that they are refusing to drill into because this is their money in the bank. Go ahead.
I mean, it's just the first. I mean, there's about four or five statements you have there. Just the first one there.
Sure.
I mean, first of all, you're talking about four or five companies controlling the oil coming in the United States. And the point I was trying to make is, there's no difference between oil in the United States and the worldwide price. The world price goes up, the price goes up and down here exactly
but
the same.
But the U.S. is
consuming. It's not like there's some additional monopoly power that's causing the price here to go up more than the world price.
But there is. We're the world's largest consumer of oil.
No, but the point. But there's no separation between the world price going up and down and our price. It's not like there's some monopoly blockage which is causing our price to go up relative to the world price.
No, I understand that, and I agree with you. And what I'm saying is that the world price, and thus the U.S. price, is being distorted on a regular basis by companies, several of which are based in the U.S., that are acting in a monopolistic way. And now they're trying to use this crisis that they've created, just like Enron used the crisis it created in California to get a Democratic governor kicked out and a Republican elected. They're trying to use this crisis to get even more leases when they're already sitting on 10,000 of them.
Well,
you know, in the coal industry, we have a law that says if a coal company has a lease, they have to mine the coal or they lose the lease. Why don't we simply do the Congressman Peter DeFazio has proposed a similar law for the oil companies. They're spending millions of dollars to lobby against this. What's wrong with that?
You know, you go and you look at the land that you lease there, and lots of times it turns out dry. You're not guaranteed that there's going to be oil on those leases.
We know that in the Naval Petroleum Reserve up in Alaska, in the Naval Petroleum Reserve, we know that there's enough. There are billions. I forget the number. Maybe you know, Carl. I don't know. But it's some massive amount of oil up there, and it has already been leased to the oil companies. And they're just saying, no, we're not going to drill that right now. We're just going to keep that in the bank. Thank you very much. And I'm saying, if we busted up these if our goal was to have more oil, which first of all, I'm not sure is a good goal for us.
I don't really believe what you're saying on this stuff. I mean, these guys are trying to get every drilling rig they can to go and drill wherever they can.
No, they're not. They're trying to get every lease they can so they can keep it in the bank.
Now, it makes no sense for somebody to control the tiny percentage of oil that you're talking about there to affect the world price. I mean,
10,000
leases?
I mean,
why would I go? I can go and get $140 a barrel right now,
right?
And if I could make money doing that, I'd be going gangbusters to go and get it.
But ExxonMobil is already the most profitable corporation in the history of the earth. I mean,
percentage profit.
In real dollars, that's again why I'm saying let's break them up.
No, but you want to talk about a profit rate. It has to be profits per dollar sold, and profits per dollar sold, they're making a 10% return, which is pretty similar to the average for companies generally. It's just that they're big and their total dollar profit is
But they're distorting our political process. This is a company that is pouring money into global warming denying. This is a company that's pouring money into lobbying. This is a company that is the actualization of Thomas Jefferson's suggestion that great concentrations of wealth would distort and eventually confront a free state. And that's what's happening.
Well, they're not very successful because they can't even get new refineries built in the United States in the last 30 years, no matter how hard they've been lobbying.
They have had no problem expanding refinery capacity. There are essentially no limits to that. There are some practically
limits
speaking.
Limits all over the place. There's all sorts of environmental regulations that don't let them expand or build. There's been something like 300 applications to build new refineries in the last 30 years. You know how many have been built? Zero.
They have been expanding the refineries that they have right now. They have this is not a problem of them being limited by in
well,
the ability.
Well, they keep on applying for new permits to build a new refinery, and it keeps on getting stopped by the courts and others.
They keep expanding the refineries that they have. I mean, right now this year we consumed less gasoline than we did last year. Why is the price up?
China's use of oil has gone up 18%.
I'm talking about gasoline. This year we consumed less gasoline than we did last year. If this is really supply and demand, and it's not a couple of big monopolistic corporations manipulating the price in the United States, just like Enron did with energy in California, why is the price up?
It's a world price, and if China increases its demand by 18%...
talking about gasoline refined in the United States.
No, but the point is, if other countries increase their demand, it's going to raise the price here. Because if you can get more for gasoline in China, then rather than selling...
But gasoline is not as fungible as oil is.
No, but you make gas from oil.
Right, but it's not as fungible as oil is. Once you refine gasoline, it's a whole lot harder to transport it across long distances. It's highly explosive stuff.
Right.
It's very rare that you see gasoline traded internationally. Instead, you see oil traded internationally.
But that's beside the point. The point is you can explain virtually the entire – I thought we agreed to begin with. You can explain virtually the entire movement in the price of gas by changes in the price of oil. You know, in whatever time period you want to look at, when you see the world price of oil goes up, the price of gasoline here in the United States goes up.
So if
the world price of oil is determined by the demand in China and India and all those other places.
Yeah, and at the same time, what we're seeing is these corporations pulling in these enormous profits. And I agree with you. I don't think that the solution is to limit their profits. I think the solution is to break them up.
Well, you know, when you're talking about...
I mean, isn't that the ultimate capitalist solution? Let them compete?
No, I think the government...
Shareholders did great when AT&T got broken up.
Do what now?
When AT&T got broken up, it lowered the price of communications, and shareholders in AT&T actually saw their wealth increase.
But it's because it had a government monopoly. It had a government monopoly. These don't have government monopolies.
Well,
it's because you were getting rid of the government protection from competition that caused the prices to go down.
Okay, I'll let you have the last word. JohnRLott.blogspot.com. Dr. John Lott, thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Past the hour, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Paul in Costa Rica. Costa Rica, really, Paul?
Yeah, that's Costa Rica.
Do you live there
or
are you visiting? Do you live
there? How are you doing today?
I am great, but I'll get better. Do you live down there or are you visiting, Paul?
Yes, wife and I, my mother live down here now. I'm retired Air Force.
Uh-huh. I've heard a lot of great things about Costa Rica. It's the only country in the Western Hemisphere that doesn't have an army, right?
That's correct. Since 1948, they've not had a standing army.
That's
marvelous. And it's the only place I know of that if you're shopping in a grocery store, you just may be walking next to the president of the country and his wife pushing a grocery cart right next to you.
Really?
Yes, sir.
Whoa.
Hey, I have two things, really.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it was in 1961 that Dwight Eisenhower, in his farewell address, warned us against the dangers of the military complex.
Yes.
We didn't listen.
No, we didn't, clearly.
Okay,
and, in fact, it had already grown at that point.
Right,
But, yeah.
Okay. The second thing, and the main reason I called, we all know that King George Bush the Lesser has disregarded and trampled on our Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as Commander-in-Chief, as he always reminds us, he is, why wouldn't he fall under Uniform Code of Military Justice and could be tried for treason?
Well, it's a nice dream, Paul, but in the Constitution, he's the commander-in-chief of the military, but he's not part of the military. He's a civilian.
Okay.
They clearly wanted the commander of the military to be somebody who was outside the military so that there would never be a military coup, essentially.
Right. I can see that. But
yeah, so he's just
would
a civilian.
Nice. They would hasten that process.
But I believe civilians can be tried for treason as well. I don't know all the details of it. I'm not a lawyer. Good idea.
Well, Rosenberg was.
Yeah. Yeah. There. You're right. Ethel and what was her husband?
Yeah.
Both of them.
I don't know how that would go about, but
yeah,
it would be a
Julius.
Nice thing to have happen.
Thank you, Paul. I appreciate the call. It's and appreciate your sentiments, and thanks for the info on Costa Rica and here, Dwight Eisenhower.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes.
Amen. Adam in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Adam.
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to tying in on the issue of Exxon with their second highest profit, the $39 billion they made the first this year. The market was disappointed, 5% worse. And so with more than $20 billion of the $39 billion, the market thought they should get another $1.5 billion. They went down 5% on the market, and Exxon bought more than $20 billion of its own stock in order, hopefully, to please the market next time, showing that all of it is financial and nothing to do with production.
Right. And by owning their own stock, they get to roll those dividends back into themselves, essentially, or to distribute that stock to their executives.
Exactly. The 5% they bought was exactly the market value they went down after they declared the $39 plus billion profit. That was disappointing.
Yeah, it's all about arbitrage. It's all about making money. Adam, thank you very much for the insight and the info on that. I appreciate it. Justin in Woodland Hills, California.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
As always, a great show. I just wanted to touch on a couple points from the caller right before the break, you know, when you guys were discussing the drilling and that type of thing. You know, there, I think it was 2 or maybe 3 weeks ago now that the Bush-appointed Department of Energy released a report that basically said regarding offshore drilling, A, there would be no consumer effect until 2030 if we started now.
Right.
So I don't know, you know, why they're even considering that. And then also, I believe it was in front of Congress, either last
week. Well, wait, hang on just a second. Let me just answer your question. The reason that they're considering that is because the more leases that these oil companies can get right now, the more money they've got in the bank. We're talking about a transfer of the wealth of we the people, the wealth of this nation. They're already sitting on over 60 million acres of U.S. federal land, land that's owned by you and me, the commons, yep. The public land, and they've already got 10,000 active leases where they have found oil, where they can drill, that they're just sitting on, and they've got this stuff, and what they want is more.
Well, they want more land, and they want it for basically nothing.
That's
and
right.
They refuse. It's like it's the same thing as like Anwar. They all cry to open up Anwar, yet the head of, I believe it was the Petroleum Institute of America, and also the top. They call them energy exploration. They're execs from like ExxonMobil and BP right. And those guys. We're in front of Congress. I think it was a week or two ago. They all said to a person, they don't even have the equipment in the country right now to begin drilling. It would be 3 to 5 years before they even had the equipment on hand to start drilling in Anwar.
Right.
So this whole, I believe it's just a big
and then they got to figure out how to get the oil out of there.
Yeah, well, first of all, they don't even have the equipment to even begin to drill. And these are the people that, you know, basically control the oil saying this, yet all you hear from, you know, many Republicans and a lot of the pundits on the conservative side saying drill here, drill now, save money. Well, it's a complete fallacy.
Yeah, absolutely. Very well said, Justin. Thanks a lot for the call.
During the long lane of the history yet to be written, America knows that this world of ours, ever growing smaller, must avoid becoming a community of dreadful fear and hate. And be instead a proud confederation of mutual trust and respect.
Dwight Eisenhower.
This is Tom Hartman. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Good time once in a while. Every afternoon. 34 minutes past the hour. Oh, downright strange things going on out there in the world. Maybe it's a little crazy. I don't know. The number one need for the people who are building the next spaceship. This is the space contractor, Hamilton Sundstrand. They're asking their workers at the Johnson Space Center in Houston to pee in the cup, as it were. They're looking for urine. They need 30 liters a day, 8 gallons a day, even on weekends. Why? Because they need to test the space toilets. Well, it doesn't sound quite so crazy when you put it in that context. And Carl was talking about this morning. Carl Wilson is going to be with you in the next hour. And John from Cape Coral, Florida, sent him a note saying, well, maybe Larry Craig should volunteer to test the space toilets. After all, he is familiar with toilets in flying places. 1-866-303-2270. Jason in Washington, D.C. Hey, Jason, what's on your mind today?
Hey, how you doing, buddy?
Good.
I wanted to actually call yesterday to speak to the economics gentleman you had on. But my question is about the fiat currency system that we have, or lack thereof, in terms of our dollars no longer backed by gold or silver compared to maybe the pound. And right. I want to know whether or not that is the true crux of our problem. When everything is said and done, that's the reason why we're in the situation today. And can we continue with our economy and, you know, move forward and see that golden age that the good doctor is talking about if we continue this currency system where our money's just not backed by silver or gold anymore?
Yeah, there is so much controversy around that, Jason, and has been since the founding of this country. If you look at the inflation, the deterioration, the value of the dollar, certainly it has spiked since 71 or 72 when Nixon took us off the gold standard. But even before that, it was, you know, the dollar was way up against an ounce of gold. I mean, it was just they decoupled significantly.
So is that our problem? Is that why we're in the situation we're in today? Because it's no longer backed by gold?
Well, I honestly don't think that anybody really and truly knows. I mean, this is a debate we've been having since the founding of this country. Hamilton thought we should have a national bank. Jefferson thought it would be a disaster because the bankers would end up having economic control over the country. They'd hold us by the throat, and they'd end up running things. And Hamilton won that argument. We had a national bank, and it proved to be a disaster. And Andrew Jackson ran on the platform of he was going to do away with the national bank. He won. He did so. This was in the 1820s, as I recall. And you know, I don't have the timeline in front of me. And then we got another national bank, the second national bank, which went belly up in 1846, as I recall.
Okay.
And then we didn't have a national bank for a long time. And then we had but the Treasury was issuing dollars. And Nixon, Lincoln had to change that, you know, in the Civil War and with the greenback and everything. And then in 1913, we got the Fed. So we got this basically private corporation that was sanctioned by the federal government. That was brought into being by an act of Congress, but it was a private corporation that would issue our money and regulate the money supply of this country. And there are many folks who say the Fed is the source of all our problems, and the Fed was one of the big things that drove the Great Depression by driving down interest rates during the Depression, although I don't know what else they could have done. But then there are others who say, no, it would have been far worse without the Fed. That back before there was the Fed, we had regularly a panic of some sort every 10, 15 years. Banks were unstable. Banks were unreliable. And even when we were on the gold standard, we weren't really quite on the gold standard because the Treasury was issuing dollars, and they said the dollars could be redeemed for gold, but it didn't say you could redeem $35 for an ounce of gold. I mean, we had the price of gold was fixed for a long time, but you know, after Roosevelt let go of that,
mm-hmm.
then you know, okay, so the dollar's worth how much, you know, or gold is worth how much, is because that was the relationship. And so I'm not sure that anybody has ever figured this out. I also don't, I may be wrong on this, but I don't believe that Great Britain, that the pound sterling is tied to sterling.
I think it's tied to silver. I mean, I'm very new to this, but I always remember as a young guy growing up, I was watching the news in the morning. I always noticed that the British pound was always worth more than the dollar. I kept on asking myself.
Oh, it is. And I think it's because their economy has been run in a little more rational fashion than ours is, but I don't think that they're on the silver stand. And I don't think that they have been for a long, long time. They have their own central bank, much like ours, and the Bank of London. And I honestly don't know the answer to this. And I've looked at it 16 ways to Sunday, and I've read all the books, you know, The Monster from Jekyll Island, and I've watched all the conspiracy videos about the Fed. And back in the day, I used to get, you know, Howard Ruff's newsletter. Well, he was a guest on the show last week, you know, saying, oh, we just need to go back on the gold standard. I think that, you know, the ideal is that the currency, the number of dollars in circulation, if you're going to have a fiat currency, that is a currency that's backed by the wealth of the nation,
mm-hmm.
rather than the amount of gold that's in Fort Knox, which actually makes sense at a certain level because, you know, the Nixon's rationale for taking us off the gold standard was that our economy had grown so large that if we maintained a gold standard, we'd have to get so much more gold. And there wasn't that much more gold in the world, and that would drive up the price of gold, and that would hurt the currency, and we were kind of reaching that spiral. So, which may or may not be true.
You know, okay.
But the bottom line is that ideally, the amount of dollars in circulation should expand at the exact same rate that the economy expands, so that $1 or a certain number of dollars, $10 always represents 1 hour's labor. And for example, or $10 always, you know, or $1 will always buy one loaf of bread. And what we've done instead ever since 1913 is we've expanded the number of dollars at a rate faster than the number of goods and services in the economy have expanded.
Interestingly enough, though, you know, we're close to 2013, so we're almost near the 100-year mark, so we can take a picture of it and see how everything worked out. Is this something that the presidential candidate should be discussing?
I think this is something that will go over the heads of most Americans. And the solution, if I was going to offer a solution, or at least a starting point for thinking, I think that historically we have tied currencies. I mean, going back to the very earliest days, 7,000 years ago in Sumeria, we have tied currencies to commodities. The early currencies were tied to typically to wheat or to oil, or sometimes or more often to precious metals. Rome was the first, you know, major empire to tie their currency, as I recall, to silver. I would submit to you that we should tie our currency to labor. Mm. What we should say is that a dollar is worth an hour's labor, or a dollar is worth 10 minutes of labor, or something like that. We should define labor as the thing that, as the stepping off point for the value of our currency. The benefit of that would be that labor would always be the prime thing. Labor would be the thing that drives, you know, the availability or lack of availability, all of that. That would be the thing that would be the dark body around which the rest of the solar system of the economy rotates, you know, or the sun around which the rest of the economy rotates. And Jack Vance, actually, the science fiction writer, who's an old friend of mine and actually is a political conservative, Jack and I would argue, and is now in his 80s living down in Oakland, and has written some brilliant science fiction, and he has this entire universe of stories that he wrote over, you know, a 50-year period in which the standard value unit, the SVU, was always tied to one SVU is 1 hour's labor anywhere in the Gaian reach, you know, anywhere in the known universe.
Okay.
And you know, for 30 years I've been reading Jack Vance's science fiction going, you know, this is something that really could work. And I've seen it suggested, and I've seen discussions of it over the years. But the problem is that because it's labor-centric, you're never going to get big banks, you're never going to get big corporations, you're never going to get the big interests that fund politics to sign off on it. But I think it's a great place to start. Jason, I got to move along. Thanks a lot for the call, and I appreciate you bringing up the topic. Dave in Bellevue, Washington. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I want to say that I enjoy your show.
Thank you.
And I think what we're
it's not necessary to say that, by the way. Everybody seems to say it's, you know, you're welcome to just call up and get right into the topic. No problem.
Okay. What I feel is going on right now is not a recession. I call this a Graham session.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Because that puts everything across there, all the way to having John McCain as his economic advisor. The other thing I point out is before Enron was having the problems,
mm-hmm.
I was listening to Fool, you know, they have that Fool.com show.
Yeah, the Motley Fool.
Ken DeLay was on that show talking about Enron a year before that and all the great things they were going to be doing.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing. Dave, you're spot on. Phil Graham is the godfather of the Enron loophole. Call it the Graham recession. You know, as Tom in Minneapolis always says, we should call it the Republican Great Depression. And, spot on. Gus in Miami, Florida, listening on Wednesday. Hey, Gus, got a minute before the break here. What's up?
Okay. Well, that's probably not going to get to what I wanted to state, but you might want to read Secrets of the Temple by William Grainer.
I have read it. It's William Grainer.
Yeah. The populists were going to pin it to grains in the silo, peg the dollar to that, and start a bank based on that.
Yeah, that was back in the 1880s. That was the Grange movement's idea.
Yeah. I just wanted to say monopolies and oligopolies benefit often from holding back on supply because it increases both their marginal and their average profits.
Yes, so and that's what I agree with you, Scott, and that's my point. That's what the oil companies are doing right now, and thank you very much for the call. And to the extent that the market is being manipulated, it's not being manipulated by speculators. It's being manipulated by monopolistic giant corporate enterprises called the giant oil companies. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Taking my country back. Son, you ain't
my friends, we're taking our country back. One House seat at a time, one Senate seat at a time, one State House seat at a time, one State Senate seat at a time, one mayorality, whatever it may be, one office at a time. And today, Don Barber is with us. He is running for State Senator. And Don, welcome to our show.
It's great to be here.
This is the New York Senate District 51. You're running against a 22-year Republican incumbent, James Seward. Your website, Barber, B-A-R-B-E-R, 4-F-O-R, Senate.com. And you actually have, Act Blue has been a big help to you.
It has been. It's a great vehicle for people to contribute to our campaign via credit card. And we were just been pushing very hard for our recent filing. And the grassroots effort responded very nicely, and this past week we were noted nationally for being the fourth highest fundraiser in the nation.
This is absolutely great. A progressive Democrat taking on an entrenched Republican at the level of the state Senate, and this is so important. These people tend at the national level not to pay attention to local seats, or not to pay attention to even statewide seats, but this is where it all starts.
Exactly.
So tell us, as a state senator in New York State, and New York State is, you know, basically an economy so big and powerful it's almost a country within the United States, or certainly within the world. As a state senator, what would your agenda be? And how would you be different from the guy who's in there now?
Well, actually, I live in upstate New York, which does not have the powerful economy that you're speaking of. That powerful economy is more in the New York City area, and I'm running to bring change in upstate New York that will protect our environment and create a sustainable economy and healthcare system for our children. And in upstate New York, these are the most important issues for us.
That's great. And Don Barber, and it's Barber for Senate, forsenate.com is the website. And Don, as a state senator, how much action is there in the state Senate with regard to national issues? To what extent can a state Senate, I know, for example, when Eliot Spitzer was pointing out when he was governor, that the savings and loan thing was going down, you know, this was a couple of years ago, and he was talking about how this disaster was coming because of these lending practices. The state Senate in New York passed legislation to protect people, and then the Bush administration came in and said, sorry, because of this 1856 law, you can't do that. But to what extent does the state Senate play on a national stage?
Well, one of the biggest national issues is universal health care for all,
mm-hmm.
And affordable and being of high quality. And the national level has been procrastinating for well over two decades on this issue. The state level, we can actually make some major changes, and we need to. And that's one of the platforms that I'm running on to take the initiative at the state level. Many other states have tried to work on this, and there have been some successes and some failures. We need to learn on that. But most important, we need to learn what other countries are doing that we're not doing. When they pay half as much as we do for health care and have better quality, there are things that can be done at the state level and need to be done. And that would be such an economic boost for New York State, number one.
You know, that's
number two for upstate New York, which is laboring under a depressed economy. What an opportunity for children when they get out of college to know they have health care. They don't have to go take a job that's outside of where they've been born or where they've grown up, or even outside of the state. They can work right here.
Yeah, absolutely. And, in fact, you know, this is Bernie Sanders really opened my eyes to this a couple of years ago. He's on our show every Friday, and for years I've been promoting a single, you know, Medicare for all, a single national, single payer healthcare system. And Bernie said, you know, A, that's not going to happen this week, and B, if every state did a statewide, you know, if we simply said at the state level or at the national level, healthcare is a right, not a privilege, and every state has to figure out a way to deliver healthcare, he said you'd have 50 states who would each be idea incubators, and providing, you know, health services, healthcare services to all of their people. And eventually you'd have enough states comparing notes about, hey, this works and that works. Like I was in Denmark last month, and they're looking at the French system and saying, you know, they're doing some things right. They've got better healthcare than we do. How can we improve ours? And that's the big debate in the Danish legislature, in the parliament right now. So,
yeah,
you know, having statewide healthcare seems like a great idea.
Well, and if they can't do it at the national level, then we need some leaders. And why not? You were just talking about the state Senate races, how they're important nationally. Well, this is the opportunity. We can be creative and we can work hard at the state level for what's important for our constituents, and then let the national, then we'll lead the nation.
Yeah. So We're talking with Don Barber. Don Barber, barberforsenate.com is the website. He's running for the New York State, upstate New York, the District 51. And how many senators are there in New York?
There are 62. And what's interesting is that it's based, our senatorial districts are based on population.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been put into a gerrymandered rural district, which is 10% of the land mass of New York State.
Wow.
There's only 62 senators. And in doing that, it's a very rural landscape, and it's very spread out, with only three cities in this whole huge district, which spans seven counties, going all the way from the Finger Lakes to the Hudson River. And I grew up on a farm, and I still work a farm with my draft horses, and this is farming country.
Yeah, that's got to help. I'm sorry.
So that's why I'm catching on. A lot of excitement from people in the district. They are just want to have someone that shares their values, has lived a life like them, to represent them.
You know, we're on the air in Missoula, Montana, and I did a show from our affiliate there, and Brian Schweitzer, the governor, and John Tester, the U.S. senator, showed up, and they're both progressive populists, essentially. And this is supposed to be a very, very conservative state. It's a very rural state. But when Brian Schweitzer puts out very progressive ideas, you know, people go, yeah, you know, that's where we're at. Are you finding the same thing in the rural area there? We have about a half a minute left here, by the way.
I am. And actually, to give you an idea, I'm the supervisor of a town, very small town in Tompkins County. And we were the second municipality in all of New York State to purchase 100% of our electricity for our municipal offices from renewable sources.
That's great.
So you can do it. Progressives can lead.
That's great. So progressives can help out, help Don Barber get into the State Senate in New York by going to barber4forsenate.com and check out the website and toss him a few bucks. Don, thanks a lot for being with us today.
You're so very welcome.
Great talking with you. And Carl Wolfson will be picking up the last hour of the show as I head off to Michigan. We'll be on WTKG tomorrow.
This is Tom Hartman. Is Tom Hartman.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman program. I'm Carl Wolfson sitting in for Tom. Tom off to Grand Rapids, Michigan. He's going to be on with you tomorrow from WTKG in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Just sitting here in the studio at AM 620 KPOJ in Portland, Oregon, looking at the monitor Al Gore up on MSNBC right now, thinking, what a different country, what a different world we would have had had we not had that judicial coup in the year 2000, the Supreme Court giving the presidency to one George W. Bush. Here to talk about a little bit of the downside of the Bush administration, the Bush legacy, Washington-based writer for The New Yorker magazine. She's an investigative journalist, and I mentioned staff writer for The New Yorker. Her great new book is called The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals. Jane Mayer, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Thank you so much. Glad to be with you.
Jane, I first have to ask, you didn't sign off on that New Yorker cover, did you?
Nobody asked me about it.
You have any thoughts on it?
You know, I've been on leave for almost a year, so working on this book. So I think that I'll leave the art up to the art department.
Yeah, great answer, Jane. You have done great work on this book, The Dark Side. And I want to get into it here because you're reporting that the International Committee of the Red Cross gave a report to the CIA last year that said Abu Zubaydah and 13 other people were tortured by the United States.
That's right. It's a very different view than the one that we've been getting from the top people in the Bush administration who've said we don't torture because torture is criminal and we don't do it. And then these are the world's experts on torture, really, the Red Cross. Nobody knows more about treatment and mistreatment of prisoners of war.
They were at these black site prisons?
Well, no.
They were in Guantanamo Bay?
You know something? They and nobody else from the outside has ever been allowed to go into those black site prisons. And so what they finally got was access to those prisoners who were in those sites but mm-hmm. had been transferred to Guantanamo. They finally got in. They got to interview them at great length, get their stories. And, you know, you've got to assume that the terrorist suspects there maybe are not telling the complete and whole truth, but the Red Cross felt that their stories were credible enough that they really took it seriously and said this is torture. This isn't even no ifs, ands, or buts.
And it wasn't just a little splash in the water, the faces Bill O'Reilly likes to characterize it as. Zubeda was up to 10 times a week he was waterboarded.
That's right. I mean, it's been described as, a 30-second wonder thing, that you just put them under a little water in it, and you instantly, pronto, get the truth. It's nothing like that at all. It was what he describes is horrible. He was waterboarded, he said, sometimes 3 times in 1 day, 10 times in a week. He was, stripped and hung by his wrists and put in a little tiny dog cage. He said they put first a towel and then later a collar around his neck and propelled him into the walls head first. He describes sort of being folded up in a fetal position so that his wounds, kind of opened up again. It was just, face it, it was not something that we would ever think of Americans doing before 9/11.
Meanwhile, we have George Bush and a shill such as Brit Hume on Fox News saying we don't torture. And this International Committee of the Red Cross report, Jane, who saw it? Did Bush see it? Did Cheney see it?
Bush was asked about it in a press conference, and he said he hadn't looked at it yet. He certainly has access to it. If he wants to see it, it's right there.
Just can't seem to find the time, huh?
I guess it's a busy job.
Yeah, yeah, and because this is illegal under U.S. and international law. And today,
Ashcroft's been testifying in Congress and saying that waterboarding, in his view, is not torture. It's just... that has been their position on this thing, and it's just becoming almost insupportable, I think. Even people in the administration, in this book, tell me, and you'll see on the record, they talk about how they think it's torture. There's a former CIA agent named John Kiriakou who was actually involved in the Zubeda case, and he says that he has no doubts that waterboarding is torture and that it's beneath America. And plenty of others, but take Richard Armitage. He's the former Deputy Secretary of State, and he did 3 tours of combat duty in Vietnam, and he is about as tough as guys come in the Bush administration. And he said about waterboarding, quote, "I am ashamed we're even having this conversation."
Right.
Of course, it's torture.
Jane Mayer is our guest. She's author of The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals. And is it your assessment, Jane, and you did a lot of investigative work on this fine book, that the CIA most likely destroyed those interrogation tapes for fear of criminal prosecution?
Well, certainly for fear of something. I mean, partly criminal prosecution, but the people I talked to also said they thought it was going to be, the word they used was unmanageable in terms of the reaction, the world reaction that there would be. What happened was when the Abu Ghraib photographs came out and the world recoiled and inside the CIA, it just sent this charge of panic through the agency because they knew they had hundreds of hours of people being waterboarded on videotape. And if the world had that kind of reaction to still photos, they thought, oh, my God, what's going to happen when they see the movies? So they soon after got rid of them.
And, Jane, it's important to point out that in the book, you point out that through torture, we got bad information, we got false information, and then that was used to justify the invasion of Iraq.
Well, yeah, I really hope people take the time to read through this book, because so many claims have been made about how we had to, resort to torture in order to win the war on terror. And if you go back over it really carefully, and I've talked to a lot of people involved in these cases, and I try to tell their stories, they got a lot of really bum information out of torture. They got some shreds of this and that, I'm sure. It's not categorical, but for everything they got, one guy at the CIA said to me, 90% of what we got was crap. And specifically, they got one former detainee to tell them exactly what they wanted to hear, which was that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq,
mm-hmm.
and that there was a connection between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda.
And we know how true those things were.
Well, he recanted after the war.
Right? Yeah.
He came out and he said, I made it up because you guys were killing me.
Yeah. There are also stories in your book, The Dark Side, Jane, about courageous people who did stand up. And we have to point out that this is also a story of heroes.
Well, it is. I mean, mean, people ask me, you know, how can you stand to write about such depressing stuff? And in truth, part of the reason I really wanted to write this book was it has not been so depressing to cover it as a reporter, because I talk to a lot of people who I really admire, who risked their necks to stand up for what they thought was a more honorable way to win the war on terror. And they're tremendously courageous people in the military. And they're FBI agents, and they're some of the Republican lawyers inside the administration. I tell all their stories. They basically risked their jobs and often lost their jobs for trying to dissent and say, you know, this is wrong. We don't do this. It's what our enemies do. We're better than that.
Our guest is Jane Mayer, Washington-based writer for The New Yorker magazine, investigative journalist. Her great new book is called The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals. Jane, I host 3 hours a day in Portland, Oregon, and the one thing our listeners want to know is, when will the Bush administration be held accountable? In your estimation, this is kind of a two-part question. If Barack Obama is elected president, we have an aggressive attorney general, we have Democrats increasing their margins in the House and Senate, how likely is it that those in the administration are going to be held accountable, or at least come to some kind of hearing for justice? And second, is it possible that key members of Congress right now, Democrats, were privy to this torture?
Well, how likely it is that there will be kind of legal repercussions, I think, depends completely on the American public. If they demand some kind of accountability, there will be accountability. If they'd rather let it go, the people in Washington will let it go. As a reporter, one of the things that I certainly would like to see most would be just an opening of the records.
Right.
You know, I want to know what really happened. I think the public needs to know what went on during this period. And in terms of whether Democrats were complicit and feel that they can't really participate or, you know, can't really push this, you know, the whole country was complicit in a way, really, the Democrats too. But there were the leaders of the House and Senate Intelligence Committees were briefed by the CIA on this program. They say that they never truly got the full picture, though, and it's only getting clear now.
Right. Great quote, by the way, Philip Zelikow, Condi Rice's former counselor. Fear and anxiety were exploited by zealots and fools. That's a great quote you got there.
Well, thank you so much.
And it's a great read. The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals. Jane Mayer, the author, has been our guest. Jane, thank you for your contribution. Thank you for being on the beat.
Great to be with you.
It's great. Thank you, Jane. And when we come back,
this is Tom Hartman.
With you on the Tom Hartman program. Tom, on his way to Grand Rapids, Michigan. He'll be on with you tomorrow from WTKG in Grand Rapids. Could be along with all of you coast to coast today. And let's check in with Gary in San Francisco, California, who says he doesn't think terrorists have any rights. Gary, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Well, especially Mohammedan terrorists. All right. All this crying and wailing and gnashing of teeth. Oh, we're not being nice to them. First of all, any non-uniformed combatant can be put up against the wall and shot, according to any Geneva Convention you want to point a finger at. That's number one.
Number one, Gary, back to you, is you don't know who is a terrorist or not at Guantanamo Bay. No, you don't.
First of all, these Mohammedans who wish to put a bomb on their back.
Okay, Gary, I think I'm going to cut this call right now. I mean, the people at Guantanamo Bay, we had to have a Supreme Court decision that was 5-4. It should have been 9-0 to grant habeas corpus. In this country, the United States of America, is a disgrace that it took this long and the vote wasn't even 9-0. You might be familiar with Brandon Mayfield. We certainly are in Portland, Oregon. He was lived in the suburbs here. The Justice Department was absolutely sure that they had his fingerprint from the Madrid train bombing. And it was lied about by John Ashcroft, who's testifying today. And this man was absolutely innocent. It was a mistake. And he was dragged through hell, and his family was dragged through hell. And people in Guantanamo Bay to this day have not had their cases heard. And you cannot stand up to the rest of the world and say, we are a democracy, we are a beacon of freedom, we are a nation of laws, preach that to the rest of the world, and then have the kind of discourse we just heard from that caller in San Francisco that they ought to be shot. It's nonsense. And you hear this from people on the right wing. We are a nation of laws, and let's hear those cases from those in Guantanamo Bay, and we will see who is a terrorist and who is not. Why are we so afraid of the judicial system in the United States of America? And, you know, this is the whole thing with FISA. Granting retroactive immunity to the telephone companies, we will not be able to get those cases into the court system now to find out what happened between George Bush, the people in his administration, and those that conspired with them to illegally wiretap. We need a robust judicial system in this country, and this administration, if they've done nothing else, is to propose a unitary executive and act as if they are the only branch of government. I just have to tell you just a couple things in the news here when we have a minute. The New York Times had a new poll out, about, and John McCain, this man is in trouble because he's trying to break his ties with the man I'm talking about, George W. Bush. This New York Times poll that just is out has bad news for John McCain. 78% of Americans say John McCain would continue Bush's Iraq policies. 61% of Americans think McCain would continue Bush's economic policy. 65% believe John McCain would not bring change to Washington. So John McCain doing a lot of PR, got Mitt Romney out there right now trying to audition for vice president, saying that John McCain is the author of the surge. John McCain knew how things worked when George Bush didn't. It's not going to work. John McCain is tied to George Bush in this legacy. Paul in Long Beach, California, wants to rebut that last caller. Paul, welcome to the program.
Oh, I just want to point out the racist
comment. Yeah, that's why I cut him.
Your last comment, claiming that these are all, you know, obviously he thinks that anybody who's a Muslim is a terrorist.
Right.
So I think it might be wise for him to look at the statistics. There are over 700 people detained in Guantanamo Bay. There are less than 300 of those now. So the vast majority have been let go without being tried or sent before military tribunals to show that they were terrorists. So I think that he needs to get his facts straight before he makes racist comments like
right.
that in the future.
You're absolutely right, Paul, and thank you. And see how easily, Paul, we fall into these pits of fear and racism when we have a government policy that is not interested in the truth.
Right.
So thank you. Thank you very much for the call. Let's stay in California. Tim in Los Angeles, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Hi, Carl. Great to hear you. First time calling you.
Great. Thanks.
Thank you. You know, like on the Tom Hartman show, and I heard your show, too, down here in L.A. on the Internet while I'm in Tom's chat room.
Very cool.
How the economy is going sour, how the banking industry is going, you know, is doing really bad. For example, like IndyMac Bank down here in Southern California. So what I'm doing is actually what I did today, and what I'm doing is going to my credit union, Communal Federal Credit Union in Montebello, California, and passing out applications and telling people to, when they pull their money out, please do not put the money like in a bank, or please do not put the money in their mattress, but please put the money into a credit union, because credit unions are a lot more safer.
That's right.
They invest into the community, and the shareholders are not.
It's not for profit.
Yeah, it's not for profit, and the money comes back to you and your interests. And also, when you see that you borrow money, the interest rates are a lot lower than banks. So this is what I'm doing to help protect the
economy. It's a great call. You know, Tim, it's a great call. We have on the morning show, the economy. People, you know, they talk about putting money in mattresses. There's one reported that 150 banks are going to go under in the next 18 months in this country. It's a great call. Credit unions, a great place for your money. There are about 86 million members of credit unions. I'm one here in Portland, Oregon. Tim, keep on listening down there.
Thank you.
Sure. Great calls. When we come back, Christy Harvey's going to be with us. If you listen to Christy regularly, you know we have a lot of fun. She's with the Center for American Progress, and we go over some kind of offbeat stories for the week. Christy Harvey will be with us when we come back. Carl Wolfson with you on the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Welcome back. Carl Wolfson with you on the Tom Hartman Program. Tom on his way to Grand Rapids, Michigan. He'll be on with you tomorrow from WTKG in Grand Rapids. And thank you, Tom, for letting me sit in on this last hour of your show. And glad to have everybody along with us coast to coast. And always a pleasure to welcome Christy Harvey to the show. She's Director of Strategic Communications for the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org. Christy, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Hey, Carl. How are you?
Oh, I'm just good. You know, I yesterday came in to do the local show, and I have this this backwards bush clock. I guess a lot of people have this.
One of those countdown things?
Yeah, the countdown clocks. And I went to read it, as I occasionally will read it, and I went 707 days, and I wasn't even thinking I was reading it. And my producer, Paul Pimentel, says, whoa, 700 days, you know. And then Tom came in with his. It's like 180 some days. But mine was obviously off, but big conspiracy theory. Maybe Cheney was rooting around resetting these clocks.
Absolutely. Well, what a pleasant surprise. It would be horrible if it was the other way and you were like, oh, there's only 100 and some days left. And someone had to say, I'm sorry, it's 700 more.
Twilight Zone.
Twilight Zone.
Oh, the country couldn't take it. We can barely take the remaining days we have. Christy, another study out about how so efficient our healthcare system is in this country, huh?
This is something that should just make all of us feel a little sick inside. You know, in my heart, of course, America is number one. But when it comes to reality, it turns out we're number 42.
Mm.
And, you know, we spend $230 million on healthcare. And even though that's true, that's per hour on healthcare, Americans are still living shorter lives than citizens in almost every single other developed country. We rank number 42 in terms of life expectancy. That's just wrong, Carl. That is just wrong.
Yeah, and, you know, beg and be number 41 isn't anything to be proud of, really.
Oh.
It's you know, and again, we have the most inefficient healthcare system in the Western world, and another example of it.
Well, listen to this. More babies in the United States die in their first year than in almost any other wealthy country. We're number 34th in terms of infants surviving to the age of one. And if you look at the mortality rates of or mortality rates of babies in other countries, we're on par with Cuba, Croatia, and Estonia.
And brought to you by the Family Values Crowd.
Brought to you by the Family Values Crowd, exactly.
Yeah, there you go. And more evidence. I the World Health Organization, the last time I looked, we were 37th on their health care quality index. But talk about health care and go from that to this story, segue into how tobacco companies are hooking kids on menthol. Am I reading that right?
This is the craziest story. I felt like I was watching the sequel to The Insider, that movie with Russell Crowe.
Oh, great, with Russell Crowe. You and I love movies, Christy.
Exactly. This is begging for The Insider Part 2. But, yeah, there was this new study that came out in the American Journal of Public Health that said that tobacco companies purposely put a low level of menthol in cigarettes because it makes them easier to smoke for first-time smokers. And once you can get first-time smokers to like the cigarettes, then they jack that menthol back up, and people are hooked. And so, you know, these doctors came together and wrote this study and said, this is what we found. They're actually doing this on purpose to get kids to smoke. And the tobacco companies, of course, came out yesterday and said, no, we're not. That's all
tobacco companies denying?
They're denying.
You know, menthol sounds like a cool word to menthol. It's like nicotine is bad, but menthol. I even lull you in there.
Well, they got busted, though, because there's an actual 1987 memo from R.J. Reynolds that basically says, hey, let's put menthol in our cigarettes. The kids like it.
These people just never learned to destroy their memos, did they?
They really should, you know. It's back in the day. Why do they keep these carbon copies laying around? They know they're going to get busted.
So this is, I'm reading here, the Harvard School of Public Health saying that menthol, as you said, stimulates cooling receptors
mm-hmm.
in the lung, and they'll find a way. They'll find a way to get kids addicted, won't they?
They will. And I don't know if you ever, you know, tried smoking when you were 12, but when you first try a cigarette in the backyard when your parents aren't home or something, it hurts. It's horrible.
Did you get the memo I didn't destroy? What's happening?
But this is why they put this low level in, so that when kids smoke, they're like, hey, this isn't so bad.
You know what's sad is that when we hear this, you know, I say shocking, you know, in kind of a satiric way, it doesn't shock you anymore.
No, but very little does shock me anymore, especially after the past 7 years. You kind of get used to stuff.
Yeah, and Christy Harvey's with us. AmericanProgress.org is the website. She's with the Center for American Progress. You didn't think you'd hear a heck of a job again, but we got another Katrina story.
Another Katrina story. Yeah, there were all of these goods that were sent down in the wake of Hurricane Katrina to help victims. Things like pillows and temporary stoves and coffee makers and hand sanitizing kits, et cetera, et cetera.
And menthol.
But they all went missing, and no one could figure out where the heck this stuff went. And they finally figured it out. They ended up at the offices of the local casino regulators for the Mississippi Gaming Commission, naturally.
You're going to double down on the wet naps, huh?
Exactly. You know, maybe that's what the slots were paying out that day, you know, food.
God. And Brownie's gone. You can't even blame this on him, can you?
Well, this was part of back in the day.
Oh,
so
maybe we can blame
you
it on
Brownie. Really,
you can
blame
Brownie.
Basically everything on Brownie, or at least go a step higher. And I like to blame Michael Chertoff for some of this stuff, too.
He's easy to blame, isn't he?
I spread the blame.
You would just cast him as the evil villain in any film, wouldn't you, Michael Chertoff?
Well,
just
especially
that
if
look.
It were a cartoon. He looks a little bit like Skeletor from the old He-Man commercial.
Ooh, you, yeah.
Doesn't he? I have a picture with him with his arm around me from a fancy black tie event a couple of years ago.
You're
prominently
kidding.
In my office.
I would destroy that quicker than a menthol memo if
it.
I were you. Sean Taylor, our executive producer here, is just applauding when you said that. She's giving you a bit of head nod on that. He is a scary, scary man. Hey, Denver's coming up at the end of August, the Democratic National Convention. And what's this about hiding the homeless, Christy?
This is kind of a weird / sad story. But the city of Denver, you know, everybody's coming in. There's going to be a lot of attention on the city. And they have a fair homeless problem. They're a city. So they didn't quite know what to do. You know, you don't want pictures of homeless people coming out across the news. So they decided that they're just going to kind of get rid of everybody for the day by passing out free movie tickets and passes to the Denver Zoo and free transportation to get them out of town. And they're going to put up big screen TVs in the homeless shelters so that people have something to watch and will stay off the streets and away from the television.
And when you say cameras. Who, Christy, whose idea is this?
This is the Colorado Coalition of the Homeless.
Okay. So these are homeless advocates?
And they're homeless advocates who are working basically because I think the fear was that the city itself would just sort of bus people away.
Okay, so this is a way to short-circuit what they fear will happen to the homeless. Is that it?
It is, but it also, I think, really underscores, you know, instead of spending all of this effort figuring out which Batman showing to put the homeless into,
right.
You know, you could spend a little of that effort, I would think, on fixing the problem or
right.
figuring out a way to come up with some longer-term solutions. But
the real scary movies the last 7.5 years of this administration. That's
right.
The one we had to live through.
Exactly.
And if homelessness is, you know, a billboard for what we've lived through in some way, you know, I say let's see it.
Well, they're painting this as a quote-unquote good deed. But it really is a way to hide the problem so that people at large don't see it. And I think that actually shoots everybody in the foot. In the
is menthol going to be used in any way to move
these
people?
Maybe they'll be passing out
menthol
and those, those extra coffee makers they found down at the Gaming Commission.
Christy Harvey's with us, Director of Strategic Communications for the Center for American Progress. Did Jesse Jackson say something worse than what we originally heard?
He did,
Christy.
And I'm actually not going to tell you what he said,
no,
but I will say he used
I'll give you some menthol.
He wasn't caught on tape, but it was in the same hot mic situation where he was talking about emasculating, let's say, Barack Obama. And he was also talking, and he used another N-word in that same conversation, and this time the N-word wasn't nuts.
Do these people in the public eye and in the media never learn about a hot mic? How many times do we have to hear a variation of this story, Christy?
People warn you the first time you sit down at a microphone that anything you say around a hot mic is fair game. I mean, and Jesse Jackson's, he's not a newcomer to this game. He's been out there for a while.
No. And I have to say that during Watergate, just reading the transcripts of the Nixon tapes were one of the highlights of my life.
Oh, absolutely.
And then hearing them played, you know, Nixon said worse, but Jesse Jackson should know better, please.
Yeah, it's he really should know better. And the fact, you know, I saw this and it didn't really, you know, I thought, oh, that's horrible. But then I started to realize Jesse Jackson's the one who's always out there, you know, yelling at different comedians or rappers for using the N-word. And to see that he's just such a hypocrite about it by using it himself just made me feel a little sick inside.
Let me get to this last story, Christy, on people who you get to baseball and marriage. You make this connection for me. I'm a huge baseball fan. I want to hear this.
It turns out this is fantastic. Couples who live in cities with Major League Baseball teams have a 28% lower divorce rate. And
really?
They decided to do, the University of Denver did a study to find out why this is, and one of the reasons is that couples who have fun together and play together stay together, and men like to do activities, and women like to have conversation, and a baseball game, it turns out, is good for both. So,
well, they didn't grow up in Philadelphia where I did, and the Phillies lost 23 games in a row when I was a kid. I think divorce rates went up in Philadelphia. That may be the aberration. I don't know. But so the study is play together, stay together, huh?
Play together, stay together. If you have fun. Fun, you know, fun should not be the thing that goes out the window first when you get married. You should always
Wow.
And people knew that, you know, that's common sense. But turns out fun is baseball, and baseball's a happy marriage.
Hey, stay away from menthol, play ball. I got some points. Christy, thank you so much. Director of Strategic Communications for the Center for American Progress, Christy Harvey's been our guest. Christy, we'll talk to you down the line.
Great. Thanks, Carl.
AmericanProgress.org. You can find all that information right there from Christy. We'll be back. More of your calls. 866-303-2270 on the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Carl Wolfson. Tom's on his way to Grand Rapids, Michigan. You can hear Tom a full 3 hours tomorrow at WTKG. And thank you, Tom, for letting me sit in on this last hour of the Tom Hartman Program. Coming to you from AM 620 KPOJ in Portland, Oregon. Pretty good Rasmussen poll from the state of Oregon. Jeff Merkley, our candidate for U.S. Senate out here, the Democratic candidate, now leading incumbent Gordon Smith, 43-41 in the latest Rasmussen poll, and that is big news out here. You know, there's so many races where Democrats can pick up Senate seats. People are talking four to eight. I think it could be as many as 8, 9, 10. Dems are making a big media buy in North Carolina, I just read, the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee. A big buy down there for Kay Hagan, who's running against Elizabeth Dole. You have people such as Bruce Lunsford with a chance in Kentucky against Mitch McConnell. It's a different playing field. And we're happy to welcome Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News, talkradionews.com, to the show. Ellen, you're getting ready for that big convention in Denver.
I am getting ready for the big convention in Denver. In fact, we have an all-staff meeting all afternoon, all about the convention. So, we're getting really ready. Today was also Tony Snow's funeral. As a colleague of mine said, Tony was a conservative that liberals actually loved.
Yeah, and our condolences to his family, Ellen.
He was really, truly a very caring and amazing person. I didn't agree with him politically, but a very nice guy.
You know, I really respect your opinions, and having met you and talked to you on a regular basis, you can disagree with people, but Ellen, you take the measure of a person, and when you say someone's a true person, I believe you.
Well, thank you. John Ashcroft today, he was in a fifth part of a hearing called From the Department of Justice to Guantanamo Bay, Administration Lawyers and Administration Interrogation Rules. Ashcroft defended the Department of Justice's action in Guantanamo, saying that they worked within the framework of the law and never supported torture. Now, of course, Ashcroft also is somebody who was not very excited about having Mr. Yu, and people expected him at this hearing to really say there are more on this, although he personally was very against Yu, and he did say that that war, the government did strive to keep within the limits of the law.
Well, but Ellen, wasn't John Ashcroft the one who was in the meetings when these John Yu memos were being presented and said, why are we discussing this in the White House? History's not going to judge us well. Wasn't that John Ashcroft who was uncomfortable in those meetings?
Yes, he was very, very uncomfortable. And so I'm sort of surprised at the tack that he took today and saying that waterboarding proved very valuable. Well, yeah. If they waterboarded me, I'd tell them anything they wanted to know.
Yeah, and you know, we just had Jane Mayer on, who's written The Dark Side. The information you get from torture is useless. People will lie. And Jane Mayer points out in her book, The Dark Side, some of this false information was used to justify the invasion itself.
Absolutely, and we're going to see some more of their false information used to justify other actions. Let me say something that I said to Tom earlier at the end of last week. I said, you know, Tom, if you think that somehow that the oil from Iraq is going to come to the good old USA through our USA-based multinational companies such as Exxon and whatever, it's just not going to happen.
That's not the plan.
Right, well. And, you know, there were these no-bid contracts. Well, now Iraq today is now saying that the no-bid contracts are only going to last for a year.
Mm.
Trust me, this oil is going to come through the UAE. It's going to come through other Arab countries. And a trillion-dollar investment, 4,000 lives, and other things like that will never, ever come to be seen if oil investment was the goal of the exercise.
Yeah, and all these promises. Oil would pay for the war, wouldn't it?
Exactly. Nancy Pelosi said that Bush's energy policy was a hoax, and she said it was the issue of our time, and she is again pushed on the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. I also want to point out two juxtaposed things. Today, there was a press conference put out called the Measure of America, American Human Development Report 2008-2009, and they said that we are doing better than we did 50 years ago. The United States most Americans are doing better than they did 50 years ago. And
what are they measuring?
The BBC comes out and says that the United States is ranking way below other developed countries in their development index. They says Americans live shorter lives than citizens of almost every other developed nation, 42 in the world for life expectancy, and that there are other very concerns such as obesity, et cetera, and that we have more people in prison. I mean, it just ragged on the United States. And this is the same time that Congress is touting how Americans are so much happier today.
Yeah, Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News, talkradionews.com is our guest. You know, I picked up Vincent Bugliosi's book, The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder. We had Vincent on the show a few weeks ago. And in the book, he goes through some of the latest world rankings. I mean, number 12 in student reading, 37 on the healthcare quality index, 48 on journalistic press freedom, 13 on quality of life, 45th on environmental sustainability index. This is not the country that America ought to be.
No, it isn't. And can you imagine them having a press conference at the same time the BBC statistics are out? It's pretty wild.
Oh, geez. You know, anything that this administration says, I'm telling you, can be rebutted the next second or simultaneously. I mean, I just don't know who's listening to them anymore.
Well, I've got news for you. I mean, they think everybody's listening, and I think that they have some of the Democrats in Congress kind of cowed because they're not standing up to them, although the leadership, particularly in the Senate, is getting a lot of pressure from grassroots Democratic groups.
Well, when George Bush comes out and says the economy is growing and we've had GDP expanded by less than 1% in the first half of the year and 440,000 jobs lost. No one's believing. Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News, talkradionews.com. Ellen, always great to talk to you.
Thank you.
And great being along with you guys for Tom Hartman today. Tom will be back tomorrow from Grand Rapids, Michigan. It's a pleasure taking your calls, being on online coast-to-coast with you as well. Carl Wolfson for Tom Hartman on Air America Radio. Remember, it's your country. Get out there and take it back.
You are listening to Tom Hartman.
For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.